our downtown skyline may change and look, the importance of historical preservation, stronger environmental policies, recognition that parts of our downtown districts have unique character and need to be, relative to their culture, and a reaffirming and elevation of the affordable housing in our central city. And I'm going to recap kind of the deliberations, I think, are the high points, and then I'd like to touch on the housing and talk a little more about that. The housing discussion, we recognize there was a need to elevate housing in a critical need in our downtown, directing resources, doing business differently, and ensuring that our vulnerable populations had opportunity to afford to live in our central city. So we've set a goal that's been discussed, the 30% of all housing production, and the 0 to 80%, and I will talk to that a little bit later about how we looked at the 0 to 80%. But there's a simple principle that people who work in Portland's core should be able to afford to live in Portland's core. And that's just, if you work down here, you should be able to live down here, or at least have that opportunity. Height, you heard Catherine talk about height. One of the key components of height, when we looked at height, that came out of it, and this is part of the future work, is what can we get from height when we look at the bonus systems and the FARs? So what, in terms of livability components, can we contribute to the downtown from a height discussion? So especially at the bridgeheads, I don't think it's fair to characterize there was not a real enthusiasm for doing the height, but there was enthusiasm for taking that height and converting that value to some livability components that may be affordability of housing and other things that contribute to a better downtown. So it wasn't an automatic, we wanted a lot of height at the waterfront. It was what can we get out of that height that helped contribute to the downtown? And that comes through the zoning code and the bonuses and FAR discussions that will come on later. The environment in the Willamette River, again, we weren't happy with what we heard initially. So Catherine has talked about how we've strengthened the policy language, added action items, and addressed flooding and other impacts. But I think that is a great start to a stronger discussion around the environment in our central city core. Third, there's an opportunity as we look at the taller buildings down in the historic Chinatown, Japantown historic district. Again, how do we ensure that Joe talked about design standards, and how do we ensure that we have part of that was we wanted standards that met the cultural competency, I guess, of that area that said we just didn't want taller buildings. We wanted buildings that were pedestrian friendly, but that also respected the cultural significance of those areas. So that's part of the follow-on work that comes with the height that hopefully gets us buildings that are culturally sensitive to the areas. Redevelopment of parking lots, we had a discussion about that. I think the plan provides us to really develop a strategy going forward of how do we implement those and get those active versus just being parking lots in the future. I think the SAC had a very vigorous discussion of that, and we had part of that discussion too, but we did not get to zoning them out or anything like that, but really moving forward with some kind of strategy to achieve that ultimately through the plan. So that's really a development. And I would say at the end here, it really is now for us to come back with a full city plan that will come back in about a year or so. That's the full city, all the quadrants, and work through some of the bonus systems, some of the zoning codes, and so you have those action items in place to look at a complete plan. And so this is a major component moving forward, but we still have a lot of work to do, and the Planning Commission will come back with a complete plan in the future. At that time also, minor issues that may need to be addressed through code work can be addressed at that time also. Specifically to the housing discussion, not in front of you today, but coming in front of you a little bit later in another month, we looked at housing and said housing, we bifurcated the 0 to 80. So we have said as a commission, the 0 to 60 should be directed toward funds. That's where the city's funds should go. And the 60 to 80 or 61 to 80 is where alternative tools should go, should be developed, so that actual money the city has, whether it's TIF or whatever type of money, is actually going to the 0 to 60 with the highest need. And then other tools may be used for that 61 to 80. We also recognize that you need to get a different toolbox and get a lot of tools in the toolbox because you don't have resources today. And what is it going to take? I'm not really sure, but there's a lot of people looking at this problem. I think today there's not only the city has, but there's other committees out there that are nonprofits looking at that. What will it take to get more affordable housing in our downtown core? And as a commission, as the chair of the commission, I think we're committed, and I tell you, I'm committed to bringing back something to you that says, this is how we think we can get there. It's going to be a toolbox. It's not one. I don't think there's a crescent wrench in there that solves this problem, but I think it's a full toolbox of tools that are not only bonuses, but I've talked to PDC about their toolbox. What can we do with them? I want to make sure that we uncover whatever that those items are. And we also want to talk about accountability. I think it's important that we examine long-term, are we meeting the goal and do we need to make other changes? So maybe every 2 or 3 years there's a review of how we're doing against the 30% and how many units have we produced. And can we take advantage of market forces if they're moving slower or faster from that standpoint based upon our toolkit that we've put together? But I don't know that there's an answer today, and I certainly, as a commissioner of the Planning Sustainability, and committing to go work on those answers through, we have a comp plan that has a housing component, and we will be working there, and then we will be coming back through the comp plan with that part of the housing, plus the central city will be coming back also that has will have a housing component.
Mr. Chairman, can I engage you on that point for a second? First of all, thank you for clarifying the housing goals. In fact, on page 43 of this outstanding document, it does note that you have proposed housing affordability at 0 to 80 generally, but you've also been very clear that the public investment, the city's resources, should be focused on 0 to 50.
Yeah.
And that's why these new tools in our toolkit, Commissioner Saltzman's proposal for a bonus system that's voluntary, potentially inclusionary zoning, and other things. So thank you for clarifying that. And under the old no net loss policy, there was a requirement of both an inventory and an annual report of where we stood to the inventory. And I think your idea of updating the inventory, and part of that is agreeing on the methodology, because we have a wonderful report from Northwest Pilot Project, but not everybody subscribes to the methodology. So I think, A, establish the baseline methodology, and then, B, do an annual or every other year report and see where we are. Because the 30% of total housing is not just prospective. It's not new construction. It's 30% of all the housing that is there in 2035. So I concur that a report of with some predictability is a good idea. And then I just offer this sobering observation that the chart that the data that accompanied the 2000 resolution on no net loss and the numbers, I got the backup stuff. And just by way of context, in 1978, there were 5,200 affordable units downtown. In 2014, there are 3,200. So there was like an extraordinary amount of energy and effort and intent to protect the housing stock. But we are not more powerful than the marketplace. And I think that the more check-ins we build into this and the more intentionality, the better, because we're going to unleash market forces through this this exercise that are going to make it harder.
Yeah, I would say two things. First, that what Saltzman, Commissioner Saltzman has proposed through the resolution is kind of the start of that process, because we need to get those tools developed first before we – I mean, it's great to measure, but you got to have something to measure. And the work that – and when I commit, you know, the commission, we show up to a meeting every 2 weeks, but it's really Susan and her staff that's working with the Housing Bureau and community groups to engage in that policy. The other side of that, and really the follow-on, is engaging the development community in an active discussion about what tools work, maybe not for them today, but over time. And I think, you know, there's examples in Seattle who's passed some things, in other cities, Boston, that start to look at, you know, how do you bring all those tools together as a city and work with the development community to achieve the goals? And we have to get that private partnership active as we go forward. And that in part is part of the solution to me, is the private partnerships that we need to bring to the table along with the public money.
Well, and you've also been keeping our feet to the fire about spending urban renewal dollars and meeting housing goals, so I appreciate that. One other question, sir. There's a proposal to add some additional height to some properties in Old Town Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one site in particular that's had some fits and starts in trying to get some development going. Once upon a time, I think there was an Y Jamaya that was proposed,
yes.
Other
yep.
things. You're proposing some additional height. What's the safeguard to the community that if we give the additional height, the building will be will fit within the fabric of a historic area?
Again, back to my comments about we are looking to put some design guidelines in that would ensure that there's design character consistent with the area where the building's being proposed. And so those pedestrian standards and the design guidelines that Joe had on the screen are what will come, that we have future work to do to create that, work with the community to say, what are those standards? We don't have those today.
These would be an overlay over and above the Central City Design Guidelines that we already have?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's a very important piece. And would you say that the principal driver of that additional height in that area is making some redevelopment economical, or a view about the urban form?
You want to touch on that a little bit?
I'd say it's both. So I guess in the interest of same potential conflict of interest, my firm worked on the Y Jamaya project, and I can tell you that it did not pencil out economically without being able to get more volume on the site.
I think the city was approached about a pretty substantial investment in that project, and there was a big gap, I remember.
Correct. So it's both, but I also think it is a district in our neighborhood with a lot of historic significance, and so paying attention to the details and how a project gets masked up, whether it steps down and how it meets the street, is extremely important.
Other questions?
Other questions? Thank you both for all the work that
Mr. Mayor,
put into this.
I have one question. And this is sort of, it's a specific question, but it's addressed to the general question of when we adopt an aspirational goal that seems like it would cost some money, what are the implications of that? And the specific example looking at is page 99. It says, create unique urban riverfront with centerpiece at Centennial Mills. Develop a uniquely urban riverfront that features an iconic segment of the Greenway Trail with a, quote, jewel, end quote, civic space in Centennial Mills, framed by high-density development along the riverfront. Now, I've heard that people have ideas for Centennial Mills that would cost $40 million, and I just basket, which I don't know whether we have or not. And I'm just curious, if we adopt this, what does that mean? Does that mean that we think that we should spend $40 million at Centennial Mills, or it just means we'd nice to have a jewel at a low price, or what would it mean for us to adopt that in your view?
In my view, it means that the city is going to go through a process to look at that property and decide how to develop it as a jewel, defining whatever that jewel is. I mean, you know, it's eye of the beholder, but I would say it's just not saying we're going to spend $40 million. It's saying the city's going to go through a process and deliberately try to develop that property and make an intent to do that. Whether or not you actually develop it becomes down to economics, but at least make an attempt to explore the possibility.
And Commissioner, if you look on page 101, then there are the implementation action items, and that was where I was going before with my comments about whether Portland Parks and Recreation can actually do everything that's been assigned to it, as RC7 says, explore the possibility of building a public boathouse for Portland Parks and Recreation, and the timeline is 2 to 5 years. If we were to do that, if we adopt it as is, we would be required to put that into our CIP and start figuring out how to fund it. So I'm very concerned, and I encourage you to go through all of the action items to see which, because I want to be realistic about what we can promise and what is truly aspirational. And I know we want to get to public testimony, but I just have to frame this because I was on the Planning Commission when we adopted the North McAdam Framework Plan, which is somewhat similar to this. There was an action item about explore the potential for a gondola between OHSU and the then North McAdam District. I asked about that as a planning commissioner, and response was pretty much, isn't this a lovely idea to think about? And then as it came, the tram came into being, I was told, well, you already adopted that. It's in the plan. So, you know, the time to complain was then. So I want to be really clear when I think we should take the time to be careful and to be clear about when it's a lovely idea and when it's something that we're actually planning to do.
Yeah, let me put this in the air for both our later discussion and maybe some reaction now from our two volunteers. But my ears are open to these comments about the need to ground what's in these aspirational plans to implementation strategies that can actually work. But I'm not sure if you're right that just because it's in the plan, it has to go into the CIP when it says explore the possibility of building something. Remember that the 1988 Central City Plan had a dotted line in it that said future urban circulator. That was as detailed as it got. It's now the Portland streetcar. So, you know, it's okay, in my opinion, to have some stretch goals and not fully formed visionary ideas in a plan. It also is important to know which are which. So I take your point, but I don't think we should, not every item in a 20-year plan should be directly attached to a budget proposal.
If it's in the 2 to 5 years, though.
Well, okay, so maybe it's in the wrong time block, but you know, over the course of 20 years, some of this stuff will prove to be doable and some of it won't. And again, I don't want us to be too short-term in our thinking about the plan. So maybe it's where it lies in the time scale rather than that we have to get some specificity about how we're going to fund something in each instance. So for what it's worth, I'm sure you've debated these points.
Well, just a little bit of perspective from the SAC, I would say that's certainly an example as well as some others where I think we all recognize as a group that more time needed to be put into determining whether it was a good idea or not, as great and aspirational as it sounded. So when we said explore, it meant explore it in the next 2 to 5 years and then determine if you move forward with it. That was the intent, and maybe it's not clear, and it needs to be made more clear.
Yeah, as I've learned with parks, even the exploring part requires staff time in order to do that exploration and a public process to plan for something, and that's not currently in our plans.
Yep.
And again, because we have to look at what does the city need citywide and where do we dedicate limited resources. So. Anyway, thank you very much. I really appreciate
Mr. Fritz, the good work. The question you raised reminds me of just a quick personal story. When I was a teenager, my father was very keen on me getting confirmed. And the culmination of this religious process was I'd have to recite the Nicene Creed in front of a lot of people. And I expressed to him at the time some misgivings because I was a little unclear about my religious impulses at the time. And he said, well, don't worry about that. Do this now, and then later on you can decide whether you want to become religious. So it was like there's a window of opportunity to get this out of the way. And then at some point, but I appreciate the colloquy between my colleagues because, for example, I would like to, at the appropriate time, make suggestions about maybe moving the sequencing and prioritization. But I think it's also important that we qualify our support for this plan in that, as you suggested, Mayor, it's aspirational. And we want to make sure that there's some things that are very specific. There are other things that are more, you know, aspirational. And I think if we're clear about that, we'll give ourselves the room to do to lead the budgeting of our bureaus and make recommendations and not be, you know, necessarily bound by every single aspirational goal in the plan. So I think it's a fantastically important question.
One of the things that we got a education about when we started the comp plan was about language, and we've become very deliberate about develop, explore, recommend. And I think it's a great observation that what does explore mean relative to your budgets. And so there may be another word that gets you there without having to expend money. And we've taken that as, and we've had a lot of discussions about just a single word. And so I would encourage you to, I think our city attorney had us go through those words of what they meant.
Well, thank you both. Anything else for these two? Thank you very much for all the time you've invested in this so far. Thanks. All right. I think unless there are any other issues to discuss now, we'll move right into public testimony. And Carla, if you would.
Mayor, can I ask you a procedural question?
Sure.
If any of your colleagues have amendments or ideas throughout this process, is it your intention to collect those after this hearing and to bring them back at a future hearing?
I think that would be most orderly. One, we're going to keep the record open unless it's something that you need to get people to comment on right now.
No, I think the testimony is going to suggest some modifications,
yeah,
as long,
yeah,
as we're clear that we can bring them at a subsequent proceeding.
Yeah, it's our intention to take testimony, close the public hearing, and then allow further time for written testimony to come in and for council to be able to propose amendments.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, let's take testimony.
Okay, we have about 69 people signed.
Okay, let's plunge in.
Okay, with the first three, please come on up, are Willie Levinson, Craig McConchy, and Wendy Aram, and they'll be followed by Mary Vogel, Bob Solinger, and Patricia Gardner.
Welcome. Good afternoon. Just need to give us your name. No need for an address unless you're representing an organization.
Willie Levinson, Human Access Project. Address? No?
Okay. No need.
I submitted testimony and had a chance to talk with staff from everybody's office, either directly or through email. My comments are, I guess, the most important part of my two pages of comments, which I really hope you guys will have an opportunity to see and consider, is that there has been a change with Portland's relationship with the Willamette River thanks to the Big Pipe Project. First, I'd like to suggest that this is added to the history section of this planning document. It was completely omitted. And I think, you know, the history section probably would be considered superfluous in a lot of situations, but it guides why people have thought about maybe the Willamette River in the past and what has maybe changed about it. We now have among the highest sewer bills in the country. One thing we can point to is the Willamette is now safe for swimming and recreation. I think that's a great message to bring out, and specifically around the Big Pipe, I think that planning in the past has really aspired to create a better human connection to the Willamette River, but it has settled for visual access and a lot of opportunities, possibly because if the Willamette was viewed as an open sewer, maybe people would just want to look at it and maybe not get into it. Now, it's vetted scientifically safe. As long as there's not a combined sewer overflow, now there's only about 4 a year in the wintertime rather than 50 to 100. So I'd consider to strengthen the document. It might help if there is an actual definition of public human access versus visual access. And one other thought is that really big ideas, it oftentimes we can get stuck. I mean, at what point will we be able to do something with the Willamette River? There was 7 studies in the last 11 years related to the Willamette River. So how do we start? How do we actually start? What are the first steps? And what I would say is that unsexily, the things that Human Access Project has in mind does not cost $20 million. We would like to slowly court the public to fall in love with the Willamette River to allow the big projects to happen.
Thank you, Will. Thanks very much. Wendy, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm Wendy Rahm, a West End resident. Bill Moyers recently devoted a full program to the immorality of tall towers in the struggle between the moneyed few and our history and livability. Who owns the light on the street? We all know that Portland used to lead. In the 70s and 80s, it stopped urban planners from building freeways through neighborhoods. It's time to stop another 80s policy, that of building tall towers everywhere. Urban planning has evolved beyond tall towers to livability, from top-down planning to street-level planning. It's time to stop and consider our generation's legacy. Are these proposed heights about the emerging dollarocracy? We need a fresh look at the West End, not just as a place to build 20, 30, and 40-story buildings that encourage demolition for density, but as a place that tells us about us, a historic human-scale area branding Portland as unique. I'm sure you've seen the many travel articles specifically on the West End in flight magazines and in the New York Times. There is a distinct character in the West End. Don't destroy the goose that lays the golden egg. The past is present in the West End's over 100 historic buildings, and these should coexist with future economic aspirations and livability. The high concentration of West End historic buildings are mostly unprotected today from demolition. If they go one by one, affordable housing and affordable offices will disappear, as well as the stories these buildings tell us. We are in the middle of Portland's story. Without its beginning, the story will lose its shape and meaning, even its soul. Let international investors build tall towers and leave, and it's no longer our story. Do not let profits be the story in the West End. Too much is at stake. One final thought. Perhaps these decisions should not be made only by moneyed interests and policymakers. Residents' voices can matter, but there was no West End resident on the sack. We are not opposed to increasing density. 8-story buildings on the many parking lots will add plenty of density and likely meet goals within a margin of error. I urge you to vote to lower the maximum building heights in the West End to 100 feet. Thank you for listening.
Wendy, thank you. Do you think that there's not sufficient protection on the existing historic buildings in addition to the height issue itself? I mean, I understand your point on the height issue, but do you think
there are two kinds of existing buildings in the West End. One are actually on the National Register, but the large majority of them are unprotected buildings. And you all have a copy of the inventory that that I did a couple years ago. There are over 100 of them, and they are not. Most of them are not protected at all. And we are seeing that.
Because it's not a district and they're not on the register. Right?
That's exactly right. And we're seeing them go one by one, very storied buildings, because the Design Commission, of course, doesn't address history.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales, Commissioners. My name is Craig McConaughey. I am here in support of the draft of the West Quadrant Plan and opposed to the granting of a continuance or delay of the hearing. I've been a property and business owner in the Goose Hollow neighborhood for 30 years. I own a building on 15th and Southwest Taylor, in which my company, CNR Real Estate Services, operates. I want to see my neighborhood reach its full potential, and I'm convinced that the West Quadrant Plan, as drafted, will achieve this. I joined the Goose Hollow's Foothills League in September 2011 and participated in the Vision Realization Committee since its inception. This committee was formed specifically to provide input to the board regarding the West Quadrant Plan. I attended 25 out of 33 meetings held. After more than 2 years of dedicated work, the Goose Hollow Principles document was formulated by the committee and presented to the board of directors, which subsequently adopted the principles statement. A new Goose Hollow Foothills League board was recently elected. They are in disagreement with not only to the content of the Goose Hollow section of the West Quadrant Plan, but the process in which the previous board came to endorse the principal's document. I can testify that the Vision Realization Committee, to my knowledge, conducted itself in a thoroughly transparent and open manner, encouraging input from all attendees and invited guest speakers. Committee meetings were regularly published and submitted for review by the entire neighborhood association. Committee discussions and decisions were not unduly influenced by developers trying to change zoning in their favor. To the contrary, most of our time was spent discussing how to improve the livability and vitality of the Goose Hollow neighborhood. Height limits and flexible zoning were openly discussed, along with view corridors and the desire to encourage the type of development that would benefit the neighborhood. I support the recommendations put forward in the draft West Quadrant Plan. Development has lagged in this neighborhood, and the need for more flexible zoning is very apparent. I oppose the granting of the continuance or delay. Revisiting the goals and objectives at this late date that had been drafted openly and publicly serves to undermine the process that neighborhood associations need to adhere to. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think the only continuance, by the way, that we're contemplating at this point is enough time for the council to take in additional written testimony and to consider amendments. We're not looking at some, unless I haven't heard anything from my colleagues, no, and I'm not intending any protracted delay in our action on the plan.
No one, for example, came to my office and asked for a continuance or delay.
Yeah.
What I will tell you is it's a 225-page document, and we're going to have a five-hour hearing. And we sometimes do our best work if we have an interval between the hearing and the final vote, because it gives us it gives us a chance to absorb all the testimony. So I concur with what the mayor said.
Thank you.
There's no other agenda that I'm aware of.
Yeah. Thank you.
We try to adopt major policy while we're awake. Thank you. Okay,
the next three are Mary Vogel, Bob Solinger, and Patricia Gardner. They'll be followed by Brooke Buxbaum, Michael James, and Marion Haynes.
Good afternoon. Mary, I think you're first.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts on the West Quadrant Plan. While I commend the West Quadrant Plan planners for the job they did in putting together a huge amount of very complex material, they made a significant oversight that I beg you to amend. As a resident of the West End who spends much of her time thinking about adaptation to climate change, I was utterly dismayed by the lack of implementation actions for the West End under environment. There was only one. This is Portland, Oregon, where we advertise to the world, we build green cities. And for the major residential area of our downtown, we have only one implementation action for the environment in a plan that takes us through to 2035. Below, I expand on the one and propose a dozen others. These ideas are not new. I've been involved in the West Quadrant Plan process since the beginning, and I have been blogging on my own website, plangreen.net, since 2009 about improving Portland's downtown. Some of the actions below build upon actions that were in the urban design items of the West End and surrounding neighborhoods. But even if the concepts are found there, they bear clarification and repetition. They include things like locally produced distributed energy. This builds on the first one, the one that was in there utilizing the brewery block's district energy system and expanding that. A tree canopy of at least 30%, and I passed along some photos of the... was that actually 3 minutes?
No, it's two. Keep going.
Oh, okay. Anyways, of some of the low-income housing that has no trees whatsoever around it. Anyway, you can read the 13 items that I propose for implementation actions under the environment section in the West End, page 84. and I'm suggesting you take out the photo of my favorite bike shop, the bike gallery downtown, and put in these items on that that page. Then we can proudly say to others, we build green cities. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. You know, of course, there are 13 items under the environment goal earlier in the plan on page 54, but they're not specific to the West End. So your point is specifically to the West End.
Yes. The West End needs its own environmental action items.
Because, yes, it's even got a performance target for tree canopy, but then no implementing items. So that's a point well made. I also understand that you've been a key proponent of the green loop concept.
Yeah, I am. I was actually amazed to see how many of the concepts from my blogs and, my previous testimonies did end up in the plan. I'm delighted with
thank,
all of
thank
that.
You for that. So, particular yeah. contribution. I think that's a very key piece of the plan throughout it. And so the mayor, I think, is right that there are pieces throughout. Thank you for your work.
Thanks very much. Who's next? Patty? Bob?
Good afternoon, Mary Hales and members of the City Council. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for Audubon Society of Portland, and I was also on the Citizen Advisory Committee. I was one of two members representing the environment that actually submitted a minority report because we felt that the environment in the original draft that went to the PSC was pretty much ignored, and we're very disappointed in that. I will say now that I really appreciate the work that the staff and the PSC have done. I think they came a long way toward addressing many of the concerns we did raise. The plan is vastly improved. I would also say that I think it still has a long way to go on the environment. To some degree, I think we're coasting on our green reputation. There's a lot of good stuff in here. The green loop, the section on Ross Island toward the end, a lot of high-level language about green infrastructure, a lot of very positive things in this plan. But I think when it comes to really visionary new initiatives, kind of what are we going to really do, the detail level for the 21st century to continue our green reputation into the 21st century, I think it's still lacking. Again, some good stuff in here, but some big gaps too. So I just want to highlight a few of those. Willamette River. There is about 5 miles of Willamette River in the Central District, and so 10 miles of shore bank. We're aspiring to find 2 to 3 restoration sites in that entire stretch of river. That is absolutely anemic. If we're really committing to restoring the river, making it healthy for salmon, helping recover salmon, we've got to do better than 2 to 3 sites on 10 miles of riverbank. Salmon need a good habitat area about every quarter mile, so we've got to aim a lot higher than that. And one of those sites should be looking at rolling back the seawall at Tom McCall Park. That was talked about a lot, something that's been in the plans for a long time. We need to actually think harder about that because it's just a discussion item still. Green infrastructure, a lot of good high-level language about green infrastructure, but very little specificity, especially at the district scale, very few specifics of what we're going to do in each neighborhood. A couple of things. We need to aim very high on trees. The targets aren't in there still. We need high tree targets. We also should really be considering either a green roof mandate or a green factor mandate. Green factor is something they do in Seattle where you can choose from a menu if you're a developer of green things that you can do on your site. But we've talked about that for a long time. We've got rid of the incentives for green roofs. It's time to actually green the city top. And we hope that you'll consider actually putting in a decision to move forward with that, not just to consider it going forward. Resiliency in the face of climate change. We'd love to see this plan crosswalk with the climate change action plan to make sure that we're really addressing it. I don't think we are. Again, some high-level language. But at a time when we should be moving back from the river, creating wider greenways, what I read in this plan is intent to intensify development next to the river. We need to be thinking hard about what the landscape's going to look like in 20, 40, 60 years.
Bob, because we are under a time constraint, on the specific areas where you think it still falls short, are you planning to send a follow-up email just with the bullet points?
We will. And my last one I'm going to say, I'd love for us to think about one thing that really isn't mentioned in this plan, and that is night lighting. A lot of cities are moving away from really lighting up their landscapes. Our city's going the other direction. I see it getting brighter and brighter and more glaring. It'd be nice for our kids to be able to look up and see the sky, and I think we ought to be thinking harder about that. Light pollution is a growing issue.
Thank you.
And Mayor, Bob, we did receive some proposed staff amendments just before the hearing. One of them was to change it from 2 or 3 restoration sites to at least 203 restoration sites. So that's edging closer. I realize that you'd like it to be 20 to 30.
Well, when I hear at least 2 to 3, I hear at least 2.
Okay. so that amendment
if at least 2 to 3, it should be at least 3.
Okay, got
but,
it.
But no, I think we need to be looking more at like 10 or 15. And maybe we're not going to get them all done, but the mayor talked about being aspirational. We should be aspirational. We shouldn't be anemic. And in this case, we are being, we know that's not anywhere near sufficient. There are more opportunities. They're challenging. But if we want the public to have access to the river and we want a healthy river for fish and wildlife and we want resiliency in the face of climate change, we've got to do this and we've got to try harder.
So perhaps Commissioner Fisher's staff and mine from Environmental Services and Parks could look at what are we actually planning to do in terms of restoration projects over and get you a number that you might be more than 3.
Right.
And then the other amendment was on page 48 to add the riverbank enhancement target of 12,600 linear feet and specify that the tree targets are still under development. So I think in both cases, your concerns have been heard, perhaps not entirely to your satisfaction, but with each iteration, we're getting closer to...
Absolutely. And again, the plan has come a long way since we submitted the minority report.
And my other... Yeah, I don't know. Is this the same minority report that came about the height issue?
No, this was separate from Enviros.
And I didn't receive either minority report, so if you could make
sure... It went to the Planning Commission, but yeah. We'll send you new comments. That's not germane anymore. They addressed enough of that those are... We appreciate that. We would not submit the same report today.
So great,
a long
thank
way.
You.
Thanks.
Okay,
thank you. Thanks very much.
Hi. Patricia Gardner, Pearl District Neighborhood Association. I sat on this SAC committee, and I'm here to basically testify that it's great plan and we should move forward on it. And primarily, I've got some data to throw out, which is, you know, the population in Portland region is projected to grow by 300,000 new residents the next 25 years. That's a lot. And they are made up, you know, millennials and baby boomers. Everybody wants to live in the central city. And so if we do not allow density to happen in the central city, where is it going to go? And so that's the challenge. You know, if you overturn just the existing zoning, which a lot of this is existing zoning, where's it going? And so that's the challenge. And I'll submit my letter. But I did want to – there were some questions that had come up earlier that I've got some answers to that I wanted to follow up with. One, regarding capping, I had the honor of sitting on two steering committees or blue ribbon panels for Mayor Katz regarding capping the freeway. And the last one is the most germane. And that's the one where we looked at the economics of it. And I would really highly recommend you get your hands on it, because what we found is that I don't think you guys are going to have to build it. There's a certain point where land is going to be such that it will be cheaper to put a cap over the freeway than it is to buy a city block in Portland. And so, you know, particularly on either side of it. And so we looked at that cost with developers, with ODOT. Everybody was in the room, and it's a very good report. Nolan Toulon was a part of it. And that is interesting. So I'm not sure you're going to get stuck with a bill. If it doesn't say that in the report, if it says parks, that's maybe something that should be pushed out, because there's other opportunities there. The other thing is, back to that question, are you bound to do something if it's in the plan? And I'm very familiar with a lot of the plans. And I remember when there was a river basin, and I remember when there was an aquarium, and, you know, none of that came to pass. And so I think you are not going to be bound if you look at the language. And there's definite precedence in the previous plans that this plan is built on that don't bind you to such, to the aspirational things, but it's important to have them in the plans because it is a 25 vision plan, 25 year. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you all.
Okay. Next three are Brooke Buxbaum, Michael James, and Marion Haynes, and they'll be followed by Paul Lipschke, Suzanne Leonard, and Kay Sarumi.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
My name is Brooke Buxbaum. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify about the West Quadrant Plan, and I'm here to say I believe that allowing the plan to go forward with the Brobdingnagian building heights it allows would be a grievous error on the part of the City Council, albeit those building heights are in the present plan. Previous errors should not constitute a precedent. My bona fides for this testimony are that I'm currently a resident of Northwest Portland, previously lived in the West End for 6 years, and I'm a citizen who's concerned with preserving what is best and most distinctive about my adopted hometown. Portland isn't Seattle, Vancouver, New York, Shanghai, Chicago, or Dubai, and it certainly shouldn't aspire to emulate them or look to them as models. The magic of Portland as a tourist destination, as a magnet to young creatives, as a welcoming community to retirees such as myself, as a home for young families, and a simpatico environment for human-scale entrepreneurship lies in its quirkiness. That is, that it's not like every other place. Its magic lies in its small town yet metropolitan vibe, its diverse neighborhoods and architecture, its intimacy, its accessibility, and its moderate cost of living. Glass towers reaching to the sky, shutting out life on the street, slick, sterile, homogeneous, expensive, just don't fit. Tall towers in the West End would obliterate a historic building stock that is irreplaceable. It would drive up rental and ownership prices. It would be an aesthetic error. It would reduce the sunlight falling on the street, and certainly we don't have enough of that as it is. Towering buildings would destroy the very character that makes Portland, Portland. And with that gone, you really have to ask, why would people choose to come here? Why would we want to lose the magic that is Portland? Why would businesses locate here? The central public space in Portland, Pioneer Square, is called the city's living room. Think of what that evokes: hominess, human scale, inclusiveness, a laid-back tempo. So different and unique compared to all the other cities I know. The West End, almost at the doorstep of the living room, should continue to reflect that same character. We need to keep buildings human scale, and we're counting on you to keep Portland, Portland. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael James, I've been a homeowner in the city of Portland for 18 years, and thank you all for letting us come here, and thank you for what I can see is a very considered study that you guys have already made of this incredible plan. I am here because I think the proposed height limits in the West Quadrant plan are excessive. Surprise. I hope you will reject them and follow the recommendations in the Northwest District Association's minority report by Steve Pinger. I hope you've all read that. I believe that that report clearly outlines the negative socioeconomic impacts that this West Quadrant plan contains. I think it'll destroy blocks that have livable streetscapes and relatively harmonious heights that now exist in Portland and replace them with blocks where there's scattered adjacent height buildings, some dwarfing others. If you've bought a Blue Star donut at the Blue Indigo, or if you walk by the Civic on Burnside, you know that I'm talking about windy streets, streets without sunlight, streets that don't and it causes us to feel comfortable in Portland. Density can be accomplished with low and medium height buildings, like in the central part of Paris, Washington, D.C., and a lot of urban Portland. Our city can retain its unique character and be a place where school teachers and fire department folks and normal folks can live, not just those of us who happen to be fortunate and retired and have money. Thank you for your attention to this plan and for the future of Portland.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales, commissioners. My name is Marion Haynes, and I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Portland Business Alliance. We appreciate this plan's focus on the role of the central city as the economic engine of the region and really applaud the staff for developing strategies to promote private sector investment, housing, job growth, retail activity in this area. For decades, Portland has made a conscious choice and significant investments to ensure downtown is dense and active. Through developments downtown, through investments in transit and things of that nature, we believe that this plan continues that commitment and that that's the right way to go. I'll keep my comments brief and focus on what seems to be one of the larger issues at hand on the heights. We do support the existing heights in the West End and the proposals for height increases in strategic areas identified in the draft, including Bridgeheads and Old Town Chinatown. This does support, as I said, our city's longstanding land use planning goals to accommodate growth by developing an existing built environment rather than pushing out at the edges. This is our downtown core that we're talking about, and that's an appropriate place to try to accommodate what is some pretty significant residential and employment growth coming to the city in the future years. We've made the investments in light rail and transit. This helps leverage those previous investments that we've already made. And it really helps continue what has made Portland a national model for activating our central city. And we meet with people all the time that want to come in and hear and learn about what we've done. So again, we support the height recommendations and recognize the need when we do that to keep a critical eye on transportation and portal capacity into the city to ensure people can continue to get in and out of our wonderful downtown. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
I have, since you're representing the PBA, I have to ask, on the housing side, do you support the goal of 30% of the housing in the whole quadrant targeted to people at 0 to 80?
We haven't taken that up specifically. It's a newer proposal, and so we'll have to get back to you on that specifically. But we have generally supported a number of proposals and the idea of looking at additional tools to support both affordable and workforce housing.
So it would be great if you gave us your thoughts on that, as well as this question about how do we get there? What are some of the concrete steps you want us to commit to?
An important issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next three are Paula Lischke, Suzanne Leonard, and Kay Tusarami. And they'll be followed by Jackie Peterson, Brian Newman, and Shirley Reckner.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Paula Lifshe, and I am a resident of the West End. Some time ago, I attended a historic Landmarks Commission meeting where there was a presentation of the historic buildings in the West End. I was attracted to this part of Portland to live in because of the human scale and neighborhood feel in a midtown location. Also, I loved the historic buildings and their varied architecture from different eras, as well as some rare single-family homes dating from the time the West End was Portland's first suburb. I am reminded of how Isaac Stern fought to preserve Carnegie Hall, the icon for the performance of classical music in this country. He argued that a new building, no matter how well designed, could not replace the atmosphere of history one feels when hearing a concert in Carnegie. In one's imagination, hearing the overtones of the ghosts of the greatest musicians of all times. When friends and family visit me here, they inevitably admire the unique historical and aesthetic aspect of the West End and applaud the efforts being made to preserve it. I understand the city's need to increase density, but I believe that density can be achieved by buildings of 8 stories or less. I am not opposed to increased density, but I hope that the city will not accomplish this by allowing building heights of 20, 30, and 40 stories, and I encourage the council to lower these allotted maximum building heights to no more than 100 feet, and I think I beat the bell.
Extra credit for that. Thank you. Ms. Leonard, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. Suzanne Crowhurst-Leonard, co-founder and director of the International Making Cities Livable Conference, specialist and consultant on social aspects of architecture and urban design. I live in the Pearl, 1030 Northwest Johnson Street. I attended almost every meeting of the CC 2035 Committee and West Quadrant SAC as a member of the public and spoke at most meetings. There are major flaws both in the SAC process and in the report. The report's strong promotion of a single vision, high-rise development agenda is in conflict with the 2035 concept statement that emphasizes livability, health, equity, and affordability. Every year, I bring to Portland about 400 mayors, practitioners, and scholars in planning and public health from around the world. They're drawn not only by the IMCL conference, but by their desire to learn from Portland how to make their own cities more healthy and livable. Portland's international reputation as a livable city was hard won by Portlanders in the 70s when they rejected the planning behemoths of their day, the Moses Freeway, the high-rise development, and chose instead to emphasize Portland's true strengths: small, walkable blocks, human scale, nature, and the public realm, a city that belongs to all, not just to the wealthy. They pulled down a freeway to create Waterfront Park, built Pioneer Square, and improved the city's walkability by creating the streetcar. Today we are at another crossroads. Singapore, Hong Kong, and the World Bank are promoting the concept of world cities and trying to shame our planners and elected leaders into joining their big boys club. These are cities that are prepared to lie down to have their unique identity and heritage raped by global investors with their high-rise condos. The 250 to 460 foot height limits in the West Quadrant plan damage the public realm, our commonwealth, but make investors drool. Committed to high-rise, Singapore and Hong Kong now have the least affordable housing in the world and a deteriorating public realm. When you permit very high-rise buildings, the huge potential profits inflate land prices. This jeopardizes historic buildings, Portland's heritage and historic identity, and makes it increasingly difficult to ensure affordable market-rate housing. And as research clearly demonstrates, high-rise is not suitable for many mothers, children, and elders, i.e. affordable housing. The supposed benefits for all income-level housing do not trickle down. Just look at the statistics for the South Waterfront or the Pearl District. What kind of a city do Portlanders want? A pale imitation of Singapore or Vancouver, BC that satisfies the global investors, or to retain Portland's unique identity, walkability, human scale, and affordability for all, and its worldwide renown as the most livable city in the U.S.? I ask the Council to reject the West Quadrant Plan's height policy and call for a thorough review of heights involving citizens, not just developers, and considering a range of height alternatives. Thank you.
Suzanne, I wasn't much engaged in the planning process here in the city during the time, I think you might have been, when the height limits in the north end of the Pearl were increased. Do you think that was a mistake?
Personally, I think it was a mistake because it encourages luxury condos and increases land prices. And frankly, I don't think Portland wants to get in that World Cities Club. I think it's much better to maintain affordability of land and maintain a population of people who actually live here and who have to work here, not just to provide opportunities for investments in the sky, as they say.
Right. I appreciate you. I respect your point of view as a planner very much, but I'm a little puzzled by this, that we found ourselves at this juncture, because as I understand it, that increase was requested by the neighborhood on the grounds of architectural diversity, that we were too monochromatic in the early phases of the Pearl in terms of the height and scale of the buildings, and that the residents of the district, I think it might have been the first time in the history of planning that this happened, but the residents of the district actually lobbied the council in those days to increase the height there. If I got the story wrong, it's because I wasn't here then, but that's how I've heard it told.
That's how I've heard it told, too.
Yeah.
But I was not involved in that process, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm just puzzled by how we could be at that place 8 or 10 years ago, and we're at this place now.
I agree. I am puzzled myself.
Okay. Well, let's continue this dialogue, because I know you've thought a lot about this issue and appreciate it very much.
Suzanne, I was curious about, you're talking about Singapore as a place with, you know, unaffordable housing. The New York Times had an article last April that actually said that Singapore is the one major world city that has successfully addressed housing affordability. And I was wondering if you want to elaborate on your comments and explain why that's wrong.
Well, I will have to look up the references that show that Singapore and Hong Kong are the most unaffordable housing in the world. They have a very special housing policy. Singapore wants everybody to have the opportunity, every Singaporean to have the opportunity to own their own apartment in Singapore. And they have had a policy now for, 50 plus years to develop only high-rise, increasingly higher and higher-rise buildings. They have a lot of social problems that have come along with that. And they also have a problem, for instance, that in order to increase productivity, they have to import, bring people in to live in the country, but those people don't get any kind of housing benefits, and they are living at a very, very low standard of housing. But I will look into the data and find you the references that show that Singapore and Hong Kong are the two most unaffordable housing, and I'll send it to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Thank you. My name is Kay Surumi, and I asked the council to lower the maximum building height to 100 feet or less in the West End and to preserve the historic buildings there. Research has verified that neighborhoods made up of small-scale buildings combined with older buildings provide two important things. They provide affordable office space and affordable housing. Affordable office space supports locally owned business. What local shop owner can afford to rent in a new 400-foot glass tower? Affordable housing attracts younger residents. They in turn increase a bike walk orientation in the city.